This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Jets trying to get a handle on it. Patrick Laine now with five shots on goal here in the corner. Jammed up in behind the net. Shifley after it. Shifley turned to Bozak. They score! Jaden Schwartz. Tyler Bozak just throws it to the front of the Jets net. And a deflection by Jaden Schwartz. And with 15 seconds left in regulation, the Blues have a 3-2 lead with three unanswered goals in the third period.
The Blues ended up winning the game, as we know, 3-2. They take a 3-2 series lead. Game 6 goes later on tonight back in St. Louis. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Alongside Dave Minuk and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. We have 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. We're all over the Jets and the Blues. The first elimination game of the series goes later on tonight. We're all over the entirety of the Stanley Cup playoffs. I should say happy Easter to those celebrating this weekend, and a happy Passover, Ezra, a happy Passover, Dave, and a happy Passover to producer Sean Assor. Gentlemen, good to see you on this Saturday morning. It's been now, you know, not quite 48 hours, about 36 hours or so, since the latest epic collapse by the Winnipeg Jets in the third period. And I have to say, that one, the one on Thursday night, was tremendously damaging for the team as they now trail 3-2 in the series to the Blues.
Yeah, Drew, it was a demoralizing loss, right? And it was almost deja vu from that game against the Sharks, right? When Joe Pavelski scored with 5 seconds left.
Yeah. Stakes were a little higher on Thursday night, though, of course.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, game 5 of the Stanley Cup playoffs, first round. It's not the regular season, but, you know, it just reminded you, you know, kind of what we've been talking about here the last 5 or 6 weeks with the Jets' inability to hold those leads, right? We talked about it last year. I mean, the Jets basically were undefeated, unbeatable when they had the lead after two periods. Obviously, you know, they lost, I think it was a couple of games, yeah, two or three games.
They closed it out. Every game you expected them to close it out.
Right. Last season, you know, it was 2 losses versus this year, it was 9 losses. So that's a big difference, guys. And, you know, before we get into everything and we get into the winning goal and the tying goal and everything like that, you know, there are a lot of Jets fans around the city and, you know, everywhere around the province and out of province that are pretty upset with the way the Jets lost. But, you know, if you want to look for a positive here, it's that no team in the series has won 2 games in a row. I mean, the series is very even.
Every team, both.
No team has won a game at home.
Yes.
And when you talk about the good scoring chances and the shots and the goals and the back and forth action, I mean, really, you haven't seen one team, I think, carry momentum. What I meant to say was you haven't seen the team carry momentum after winning 2 games. Because after the Blues went up 2-0, the Jets' best games were in games 3 and 4.
And then no question.
And then after game 4, I mean, the Jets score early and they get the 2-0 lead, but the Blues were the better team in the first period. I don't care what anybody says. You go back to that game and you can see the high quality scoring chances that Sundqvist had, that Jaden Schwartz had, that Ryan O'Reilly had. I mean, Connor Hellebuck had to be excellent in that first period. Not only could that game have been tied, the Blues could have been up in that period. So I realize that the Jets had the 2-0 lead going into the third period, but that had a lot to do with the way Hellebuck was playing. And I think it's really unfair for people to be criticizing Hellebuck for that third period, because I don't think the Jets are up 2-0 unless Hellebuck makes, you know, 6 or 7 really good saves. So I realize that it's the way they lost, Drew, and it's really tough when a team scores with 15 seconds left, and as opposed to the Jets going up 3-2, or at the very least going to overtime and have the opportunity to go up 3-2, now you're down 3-2 going back to St. Louis, but the Jets have been right there with the Blues the whole series. I mean, this series could easily be 3-2 Jets. It could easily be over. I mean, the Jets could have won 4 games by now. You go back to game 1.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem in a nutshell, though, Ezzy, is that the Jets haven't been able to figure out a way to close out the St. Louis Blues. And don't get me wrong, the St. Louis Blues are a damn good hockey team. But when you're up 2-0 in the game, and granted, St. Louis has been controlling, in my opinion, a lot of that play, especially in the first period where the Jets ended up being up 2-0. The Blues were the better of the two teams in the first period. And then in the second period, the Jets get a 4-minute man advantage after Kulikov gets high sticked and they're on the power play, and they don't do anything on that power play of any significance to extend the they don't do anything to extend the lead. And then the third period starts and they're shorthanded to start the third period with Trouba in the penalty box, and then the Blues get the goal to cut it in half. And I don't know anybody in that arena who felt confident that the Jets would be able to maybe match the Blues goal in the third period to extend the lead back to two, or to maintain that lead. You know, when the Blues scored with 15 seconds to go to win the game, people were like, yeah, that's exactly what we expected to happen.
Well, I don't know if anybody can say they expected the Blues to score with 15 seconds left.
They've watched it happen all season long. To me, that's the big problem.
I think the lead was the 2-0 lead was misleading.
I agree.
Is what I'm saying. But it's a lead. Your point is well taken. If you're up 2-0 in the third period, you're at home, you have the opportunity to go up 3-2, you got to shut it down, period, right? But what I'm saying is the Blues were playing well the whole game. That's my major point here. So it's not like the Blues just turned it up in the third period.
I thought the Blues' best players in the third period were better than the Jets' best players in the third period. And that is...
But you could argue that the Blues were better in that game as a whole.
Yes, I would make that argument.
So that's my point. I mean, you know, you talk about, you know, expected goals and scoring chances and all of that, guys. And, you know, I go back to the first period and I thought the Jets' best period was actually the second period.
I agree.
Not the first period. And, you know, Lowry scores 12 seconds in. Kevin Hayes scores that beautiful goal. And Kevin Hayes had an opportunity to score another goal. He was really good. And I know you want to get into, you know, Hayes usage and the fourth line usage and all that. But this was a close game. It's not like the Jets were up 2-0 and, you know, the Blues didn't have any good scoring chances. And, you know, this wasn't a close game. So the Jets, at the end of the day, the Jets blew another lead. And that's been a narrative here for a good part of the second half of the season. I agree. All I'm saying is you have to keep in mind, factoring in everything, you have to keep in mind how closely matched these teams are and how momentum doesn't really carry over from game to game. So, yes, the Jets were the better team in games 3 and 4, but once you get in game and the Blues had their pushback, they go down 2-0 and they're pushing back. They're trying to get that tying goal. They were trying to get the first goal, obviously, but I thought, you know, after the Blues made it a one goal game, it was on. I mean, all of the momentum was in the Blues corner, right? So I'm just saying that as a whole, that game, the Blues were in that game the whole time. And I think the Jets were lucky to have a 2-goal lead in the third.
I agree with you there. And then what happens in the third period, in my opinion, is the Jets don't play like they are fortunate to be up 2-0. They play like they're afraid because they know they're up 2-0. The Jets played that third period to not lose as opposed to win. And then, so St. Louis, you know, is a damn good hockey team. So they get the early power play goal and then they just come in waves. And the Jets had no response to speak of. And, you know, when they tie it up on the goal that I do think should have counted, that being the Blues' second goal, there's no question in my mind that that was a good goal despite the you know, the goalpost maybe lifting up a little bit, the Shen goal with, you know, 6 minutes to play. The Blues played to win the game despite being down 2-0. The Jets played, in my mind, as if they were tentative and that they were scared to play their style, Dave.
Well, and I just thought for that second goal, the Jets defense was not very good. I mean, and that, by defense, I mean collective team defense. You had Wheeler standing there. You had Scheifele late into the zone. You know, Shen and I think Schwartz may have been on the ice as well. Both got in behind all the Jets. All the Jets were standing around watching the puck and not obviously their man. And as a result, you know, you've got these guys who are wide open who put that pass Hellebuyck. I thought it was a good goal too when we were at the arena and when we first saw it, before we had even seen the replay, I thought it was going to be a good goal.
Yeah.
Then we saw the replay. I thought, well, that's for sure going to count. And obviously it did. I think, like, to Ezzy's point, I think it's a very close game. It really could have gone either way. I don't think I anticipated that the Blues were going to score that goal with 15 seconds to go. But to your point, Drew, I don't think anybody was terribly surprised based on how things have gone for the Jets this season. But, you know, I mean, I guess it becomes a function of just knowing the situation. I was a little surprised that they didn't have the Lowry line on to kind of shut things down towards the end, because, you know, and there was some talk about trying to win it. I thought to myself, really, do you want to try and win it? You know, and overtime kind of creates a fresh sheet of ice, a fresh opportunity.
To take a deep breath that's and say, I mean, we've survived their push.
That's right. We got their push. We've handled it. Now we can start fresh. Both teams are kind of on the same surface there, as opposed to a Blues team that has a little bit more momentum because they've tied it up with 6 minutes to go in the third period. So I thought from that perspective, from a Jets perspective, maybe not that you go into a complete defensive shell, but you have to maybe have your best defensive unit on there, mm-hmm. especially with the game, you know, in that sort of situation. So I was a little surprised by that choice. But again, like I said, you know, it's presence of mind. I mean, you know, Trouba holding onto that puck behind the net for trying to kill it.
There's 30 seconds to go in the period. That is an inexplicable play. You know, that is a player who doesn't have confidence to make the appropriate play in that instance. That is a player who is hoping and praying to be able to bail out on that situation.
Well, you know what? I don't know. I mean, to me, I wonder if it's more a function of presence of mind. I wonder if he was trying to figure out, because at one point I saw on the replay, he kind of looks up at the clock. And so I'm curious to think, you know, maybe he didn't have an understanding as to how much time was left in the game. So I don't know if it's a player. I wouldn't know if I'd go that far, because Troop is a fairly confident. I'm not saying he doesn't make mistakes, but I don't know if I'd go to that degree, Drew. I just think from his perspective, he wasn't aware of the time that was remaining in the game. Probably thought he could do that, kill the clock, and then get out of it. And obviously they weren't able to do that.
I was just going to say, you know, I think I would agree that wasn't the best decision by Trouba. The one thing I wanted to mention, and, you know, it was mentioned after the game, but I think, you know, Craig Berube decides to put David Perron on the top line. Mm-hmm. He switches Braden Schenn and David Perron, and I really thought, you know, the first line played better after that, mm-hmm. and that was a big key there. And, you know, you can say whatever you want about David Perron, and he's been a Jets killer. You remember that goal that he scored in overtime when he was playing for Vegas, and over the years when he mm-hmm. was on the Blues before he went to the Golden Knights, right? And obviously, I think he was on the Oilers in between there. He's been on a few teams.
Penguins for a while.
Yeah, he's been on the Penguins.
Yeah, he's bounced around.
And Perron has been a big factor. And it goes kind of back to what I said before. I mean, Scheifele, Connor, Wheeler, they were by far the Jets' best line in Game 4. They were good in Game 3. And, you know, I thought they were outplayed by the O'Reilly line.
No question.
I really think, you know, when you go back to the Jets and when they've had success and you look at recently Games 3 and Game 4, I mean, it's speed, it's sustained offensive zone pressure. And, you know, with the exception of, you know, a few good chunks of periods, I mean, we didn't see that, guys. When you think about the start that the Jets had.
12 seconds
in, and then Hayes gets that goal. I mean, I personally thought that was going to be a 5-1, 6-1 Jets win. I mean, just based on the way they played in the first, you know, 10, 12 minutes. And then, you know, or maybe not 10, 12, maybe, you know.
10, 12 seconds.
Well, yeah, but no, but maybe, you know, 6 to 8 minutes. And then the Blues started to come on there. And, you know, I thought Oscar Sundquist was noticeable again. And this is a guy that I don't think a lot of people know about. He was acquired in the Ryan Reeves trade.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a big body. He's got that physical element to his game. And I just didn't think the Jets had as much offensive pressure as they did in the previous two games. And you wonder, and, you know, both teams don't want to go down 3-2. So, you know, Drew, you mentioned that, you know, the Jets were playing a little bit scared and they were playing not to lose. And I agree with you, especially in the third period. I just thought that, you know, the Jets at points in that game didn't have a response for how tenacious the Blues were on the forecheck. And they can play that physical game. And I think we've seen that over the years. I mean, the Jets have been more successful against those physical teams. They in the past have struggled more so against kind of the similar speed type of transition teams. And, you know, going into game 6, I mean, we talked about it earlier. I mean, this is a toss-up game, guys. I mean, this could go either way. When you've had 4 of the 5 games, Dave, mm-hmm. that have been one-goal games, I mean, why would you believe that this game is going to be any different? I wouldn't expect a blowout either way.
No, I think it will be a close game because, to your point, exactly right, that these two teams are very evenly matched. I think it comes down to which team has their best players step up tonight. Do the Jets, do Scheifele, Wheeler, and Connor bounce back from a poor performance in Game 5 and carry the team on their shoulders to Game 6. TLC wasn't as good in Game 5 as they were in Game 4. Mm. Do they bounce back? You know, the Jets need to match their effort that they've seen so far in St. Louis to send the game back home for a Game 7. I'm not sure if they can do it or not. That's obviously what we'll talk about throughout the course of the show today. But, I mean, Ben Chiarot said it very succinctly on the post-game show when he did the walk-off interview with the guys from the booth. He said that was a kick in the nuts. And it was. I mean,
sometimes you're the hammer, sometimes you're the nail.
That's what he said, right? In game, you know, after game four, and then game five, that was a kick in the nuts way to end the game. Can the Jets recover from that? Can they bounce back from that? Can they take this game back home to game seven? They have to be a lot better, and they have to play like they have to play looser to some degree, in that they can't be so tentative and they can't be so tight that they're afraid to play their game, which is what I think happened in the third period on Thursday night.
Yeah, I agree. And this series has been unique because the first goal has not been as important in other series. It's really how you finish, right? I mean, getting the first goal for both teams has not really led to success, right? So it's really going to come down to that third period.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if we're tied going into the third period. I mean, forget the 99 points each, because I really think if both teams were healthy, these would be 105 to 110 point teams.
Points obviously don't matter because you see Calgary and Tampa Bay.
That's what I just said. I said forget the points. But they really are even. I mean, when you're talking about, I agree though, when you're talking about 128 points versus what did Columbus have?
99.
99. So, I mean, doesn't matter if you're separated by 30 points or 1 point.
No, the regular season in the NHL doesn't matter.
These teams, anybody that's watched this series knows that these two teams are evenly matched. That's all I'm saying. Just don't expect, you know, any momentum to necessarily carry over. I think the Jets are going to win game six. I think we're going to have a game seven on Monday. Remember what I said last Saturday, boys? Said the Jets were going to win game three. So obviously, I know everything.
Nostrazzi.
Yeah, let's not get carried away now. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Jets and the Blues. Look at the forward groups. Maybe have a little conversation about what if Nikolaj Ehlers can't go tonight for the Jets. How does that change things around? You're listening to Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
And now Dustin Byfuglien is on the loose puck. Byfuglien hits the line and in. Byfuglien plays it for Kevin Hayes. Hayes drives it to the net. Score! Kevin Hayes comes in on the offside, the big left-handed shooting centerman, and he'll cut around Joel Edmondson and jam this one home, and the Jets have a 2-0 lead.
Kevin Hayes scoring Thursday night for the Jets.
The best fourth-line center in the game.
Well, if he's the best fourth-line center in the game, then his usage, especially in that third period, and his time on ice in that game was certainly a curious decision by Jets head coach Paul Maurice. Talk about the forwards, talk more about the Jets and the Blues this segment. Welcome back to the program. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290. This segment of the show is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the entire family. To make an appointment today, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. So Kevin Hayes certainly was noticeable in Game 5, at least for the first couple of periods. He was noticeable. He had that very nice goal late in the first period. He was about to score another goal and then accidentally, sort of in his effort to put the puck into the Blues net, knocked it away from trouble, which was sort of just one of those...
Apparently his stick had broken, and so that's why...
That's
what Coach Marie said. His stick had broken, and then so as a result, it wasn't flat on the ice, and so it pulled it back.
I see. Well, he should have had a penalty then for playing with a broken stick. In any event, he was very close to having at least two goals in the game, and then in the third period, he just doesn't get any ice time. That fourth line for the Jets, really no ice time to speak of in the third period. A couple shifts here, a couple shifts there. The usage of the Jets forwards in that third period was bizarre to me, including not having, as you alluded to in the first segment, guys, not having Tanev, Lowry, and Kopp on the ice for the last shift of the game where the Blues ended up scoring with 15 seconds to go. You go with Connor, Scheifele, and Wheeler. They were on the ice, in fact, for both of the Blues' last two goals. You know, to me, that's just poor. That's a poor decision by Jets head coach Paul Maurice in that instance.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, again, I said that last segment. To me, you've got to have your defensive line on for that to get that game to overtime. I just don't understand the rationale there because, you know, I mean, again, Drew, we talked about it. St. Louis had been battling and they tie the game up. And I'm not saying that you've got a fragile group, but you've got a group that, you know, we have seen this season not been able to hold a lot of third period leads. And overtime changes everything. So...
It's a fresh slate.
It's a fresh slate. So I would be more inclined to have gone with that more of a defensive mindset because, again, we saw on the second goal that the Scheifele-Wheeler line, you know, allowed that goal against.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just on Byfuglien and Sherratt, although Sherratt was standing around kind of in no man's land.
And Sundqvist beat Byfuglien clean.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so it's, but the problem was it just didn't seem to be a lot of support.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a function of one guy getting beat, because if one guy gets beat, you should have some support to cover for him. And as a result, unfortunately, like we said, guys were standing around watching the puck and they weren't watching the men. And as a result, Shen gets behind everyone, behind Sherratt, and past Scheifele, and Schwartz was there as well. So even if Shen doesn't get it, I think Schwartz was the extra guy who had a chance to bury that puck. So, I really think like that Lowry line was the one you probably want to lead with to close out that period and get yourself into the
overtime. You're reeling. You're a team that has no confidence to speak of in the third period because you've lost so many leads this year. You're reeling because they've tied the game. You're on your heels. Mm-hmm. How important in that instance would a shift have been where, Tanev, Lowry, and Kopp, who are so good at it, we've seen it for so many years now, are so good at just keeping the puck in the offensive zone for the entirety of a shift, mm-hmm. just to get the Jets confidence, to get them feeling better about themselves. Instead, it's just a disaster of a shift. I mean, and sure, the Blues are a little bit fortunate in that, it looks like a harmless play, but, Jaden Schwartz makes a great play to get his stick on the Tyler Bozak, he fires it blindly at the net. And Schwartz does a great job of getting a stick on it. But you need a shift where you have players who are defensively, just the utmost and defensively responsible on the ice. And that wasn't the shift that the Jets had out there right there. I look at the coaching in this game, and I look at, you talked about, Izzy, the big change there in Craig Berube swapping around his first line, putting David Perron up with O'Reilly and Tarasenko, and moving Shen to the middle, and putting Schwartz with, Shen between Schwartz and Sundqvist.
Right, Sundqvist between, right, Shen.
Shen moved to the middle, well, Sundqvist moved to the wing.
Right, but Sundqvist is usually the center of the second
line. Right, but Shen can play center or wing, so he moved down. Right.
They were rotating, essentially, is what they were doing.
Right, but I'm saying that is a coaching win by Craig Berube, whereas Paul Maurice didn't have that, and he hasn't had that in this series in my mind, is that Berube has done a better job with his line matching, with his decision-making with his lines, than Paul Maurice has done for the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah, I can see that argument. I mean, are we talking about that if the Jets win Game 5? Probably not, right?
Probably not. You're right. But, I mean, the reality is the moves he made paid off.
Yes.
The moves Maurice made had not paid off.
Right. No, I agree with you. I mean, Paul Maurice didn't change any of the lines in Game 5, and I agree. I wasn't expecting Game five for you to see the fourth line play that amount of ice time.
Well, so let's look at the fourth. So Hayes played 9:39. Sorry, Perreault played 7:39, and Jack Roslovic played 8:27. Matthew Perreault is supposedly is a possession monster. That's his reputation. That's the praise of him. To only have him out on the ice for 7:39 in the course of an entire game. Isn't enough ice time. And I know he took the penalties in Game 4, but this was Game 5. He didn't take any penalties on Thursday night. It's just odd decision-making and rolling your lines in that manner.
Right, and especially when the line was pretty good. I mean, we talked about the Kevin Hayes goal mm-hmm. in the first period, but they had chances. And mm-hmm. I actually think Jack Roslovic has really gotten better as the series has progressed. I thought, Games 1 and 2, he wasn't as big of an impact. And I actually think Matty Perreault, I mean, we know Matty Perreault is going to be solid, really, on whatever line you put him on. And, we talked about Nikolai Ehlers before the break, and, there's a chance that Ehlers is going to play, but if he doesn't play, I mean, Paul Maurice is going to have a really tough decision to make, right? Because who are you going to elevate to that second line, right? Are you possibly going to move Kevin Hayes up to that second line, or are you going to move Matty Perreault up to that second line? I mean, we've seen Jack Roslovic also at times on that second line. Not a lot, but I mean,
what would you do?
It's tough to say, right? Because I most likely would probably move Matty Perreault up to that second line.
I agree.
But when it's tough, when you have that decision, I mean, it's going to affect other lines because I think you want to keep TLC together. But if you don't want to keep TLC together, Dave, then, I mean, you're possibly going to move Brian Little somewhere else. And if Ehlers is out of the lineup, it might affect more than just one line.
Oh, it certainly will. I mean, first of all, and it's a big if. We don't know. We saw him block the shot in the third period, and he was struggling, and he wasn't on the ice yesterday, and Paul Maurice said he thinks he's good to go, but
he was more confident than that. He said he was probable.
Okay, well,
I'm just saying the word he used yesterday was probable.
you know.
Now, I'm not saying that he couldn't have a setback, and they basically said he's going to keep him off the ice.
Yeah.
But his exact words were, he feels good today. I'll list him as probable. He won't skate today. We probably won't put him out for the morning. Obviously, that's today. But he feels good.
And David's game six as opposed to game one or game two. So this is an elimination game.
Yeah.
So you got to think if Nikolai Ehlers is, 75-80%, he's playing.
Par Lindholm come into the lineup if Ehlers is out? Could you see them going with anyone other than Lindholm?
No.
Not that I'd expect Matt Hendricks would be the next man up or anything, but
no, it would be Par Lindholm just based on the fact that he was the last guy in the lineup, right. Drew? So, but I mean, speaking of the fourth line's usage, if Ehlers is out, then the fourth line is going to play the same, if not less.
I would think they'd even play less. If you're talking about a fourth line of what? Hayes, Roslovic, and Lindholm? Because if he splits up Tanev, Lowry, and Kopp, you can't split them up. You're overthinking things, given their performance this series. And they weren't great in Game 5, but how great they were in Game 4. You're overthinking things if you split them up, because you're already going to be, even if you moved Lindholm, to where Kopp is on that line or something like that, it's not like you're having an offensive fourth line, with Andrew Kopp there instead of Par Lindholm. Keep Tanev, Lowry, and Kopp together, and, you're going to be playing a fourth line very probably sparingly, which is unfortunate, but, I would move Perreault up because Roslovic didn't really show me that much when he was up playing on the second line earlier in the series. When Tanev wasn't back in the lineup, that would be how I would do it. But the Jets really, I think, truly do need Nikolai Ehlers to be in the lineup tonight.
Right, and exactly. Hopefully, Paul Maurice doesn't have to worry about that, because also the second line has just been so good, right? Patrick Laine is playing his best hockey of the year. I think we'd all agree with that, right?
Absolutely.
And Brian Little was spending some time on the wing. Now he's back to his usual spot centering that line. So Ehlers, Laine, and Little have been really good. So I think it's almost more so that you want to keep, if it's not broken, don't fix it, right? So that to me is, Nikolai Ehlers, I think, has played very well for a guy that hasn't scored a goal yet.
Yeah.
And he didn't score a goal, obviously, last year either.
Yeah.
But, when he uses his speed, he's effective. He can be effective on the power play as well. So let's just hope that Ehlers is ready to go for game six, because they really need him.
Exactly. Let's head out to St. Louis when we come back. Mike McIntyre, the Winnipeg Free Press, is going to join us for, of course, more on the Jets and the Blues game six later on tonight here on TSN Radio 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day. Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk with you on this Winnipeg Jets Game Day, Game 6 between the Jets and the Blues a little bit later on tonight. You can hear it on this fine station. While in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. That's the best way to reach us here in studio. You can also do it via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website has got the absolute latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio. That's IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We head out to the Enterprise Center in St. Louis, where we're joined by Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Yeah, Mike, appreciate it. Obviously, a big game going on tonight. But before the Game 6 gets underway, you can't help but look back at Game 5. Mike, does this Jets team, do they have the intestinal fortitude? Do they have the right locker room to bounce back from what is such a demoralizing defeat in Game 5, being up 2-0, losing with 15 seconds to go? Do they have the granite in that locker room to be strong enough to sustain that kind of loss?
Well, we're sure going to find out. But one thing this Jets team has is a lot of experience coming back from these sorts of frustrating or devastating losses, if you will. Of course, none of the previous blown leads this year have been quite of the magnitude of this one. But, of course, these Jets have had all kinds of trouble locking down games, and we've seen them bounce back from situations that, you say, well, that's going to be devastating to them, and then they come right back. And, of course, we have recent history as well that these Jets, after losing games one and two on home ice, no small task, came down here to Missouri and won, played, I thought, two very, very well-rounded, complete games to get the series back even. And of course, we know what happened now in game five, but certainly the Jets have had a lot of experience. I guess it's a bit troubling that they have so much experience in that area. But, I don't think there's any question this team has it in them. Now, whether or not they can actually get it done is another story, because I would think if you're the St. Louis Blues, you must feel like you got away with one the other night, and you don't want to be in that same position again. And if you're the Blues, you want to come out, establish home ice tonight, and not give the Jets any signs of hope.
Mike, in yesterday's Free Press, you wrote about Paul Maurice's usage of Matty Perreault and Jack Roslovic and Kevin Hayes on that fourth line. And a lot of what Paul Maurice does for Game 6 has to do with whether or not Nikolaj Ehlers is going to be in the lineup. But regardless if Nikolaj Ehlers is in the lineup or not, we're expecting him to be in the lineup. But what do you expect Paul Maurice to do with that fourth line? And again, that, I guess, with the caveat to that would be that it also depends on, you know, whether the Jets are leading or not in the game.
Yeah, I was a little surprised to look at the ice time the other night and see that fourth line only played, you know, 7-8. I think Hayes was just over 9. He got a little bit of power play time. That's not a lot of minutes. And you know, I spoke to one exec who said this is sort of part of a pattern we've seen all year with the Jets, where Paul Maurice leans heavily on his big guys. We know Blake Wheeler, Mark Scheifele, those guys play an absolute ton. They were, you know, minute eaters during the regular season. And the theory out there, of course, whether it's true or not, I guess, is up for debate. But certainly the theory is that the Jets run out of gas, and that we've seen that not only at the end of games, but maybe towards the end of the season when they kind of limped across the finish line, that they wore a lot of their big guys out. And it's interesting, that fourth line, I thought the other night, was very effective. I mean, my goodness, Kevin Hayes, as Paul Maurice, I think, said following the game, he could have had a hat trick on his stick. He had a lot of chances. And it's interesting, though, as the game got into the later stages, that line wasn't seeing the ice very much. And, in fact, they didn't really see the ice at all in almost the last half of the third period. I think they had one or two shifts, and then that was it. So it is interesting that you had a line that seemingly was going pretty good, and you had a lead. And what changed? Well, you stopped rolling four lines, and sure enough, the Jets did something we've seen them do far too often. Now 11 times this season, 9 in the regular season, 2 in the playoffs in this series alone, and that is turn a third period lead into a loss.
So, Mike, if you're a glass half full kind of guy, what can you look forward to tonight, thinking that the Jets are going to go into St. Louis and take this one and force a game 7?
I think there's something like 10-2 in this building over their last dozen games, including 4-0 this season. The Jets, they play very well here in St. Louis for whatever reason. They haven't been able to translate that success back on home ice, where they've now, I believe, lost 4 straight games to the Blues dating back to the regular season, 3 in this playoff series and the final meeting of the regular season, a 1-0 loss. But the Jets seem to play well as well when their backs are against the wall. Blake Wheeler talked about, you know, knowing when the chips are down, and this team has the ability, it seems, and we certainly saw that last year, right? I mean, I think back to the second round series last year where the Jets lost game 6 on home ice in pretty frustrating fashion. I would say more frustrating than how they lost the other night. It's not like they blew a late lead they had. They just got outplayed in game 6, and it looked like they were done, right? And then they go into Nashville, and they win game 7 in pretty dominant fashion to take that series. Now, we know that this group isn't necessarily following in the footsteps of what last year's team did in the regular season and certainly so far in the playoffs, but they do have the bulk of the same players back, and there's a bit of a battle-tested, battle-hardened feel to this group. They're going to have to go out tonight and do kind of what they did in that Game 7 in Nashville last year just to get this back to a Game 7 in Winnipeg on Monday night.
Mike McIntyre is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals, Winnipeg Jets, Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day, the Jets and the Blues Game 6 later on tonight in St. Louis. Mike, you listen to the Jets comments post-game, you know, Connor Hellebuck saying, you know, the difference was that the Blues, you know, the puck pinballed onto them in good positions. Are the Jets disrespecting their opponent? Are they disrespecting the fact that, from really my observations, and I think most independent observations, the Blues were the better of the two teams in Game 5?
Yeah, and that had a real sense of hanging on for dear life. I mean, you knew that first power play to start the third period was going to be a big one. And think about it, eh, guys? The Jets had a chance to clear that puck without a whole lot of time left in the man advantage. They whiffed on it. Ryan O'Reilly made them pay with that goal, and now it was game on, because you knew that that planted the seed of doubt in the minds of the Jets and certainly their fans, who have seen this movie play out far too often this year. And I thought the Blues really took it to the Jets. It's interesting to hear that the Jets talk about they seem to like their third period the other day. I'm not sure why that is. I like parts of their game prior to the third period, and they had a 2-0 lead, which actually could have been more had they been able to capitalize on a few other chances they had. Certainly that 4-minute power play where they only generated the one shot, to me that was a real turning point. You could see the Blues get a lift from that. The Jets could have probably put them away there if they score a goal. They didn't. They let the Blues hang around, and the Blues made them pay. So I don't know if it's disrespectful, maybe a little delusional, but hey, at this time of year, you do what it takes, right? And if that's what the room needs to hear from itself to convince itself, then so be it. I'd take everything with a grain of salt, though, coming out of the mouths of players. I think the Blues certainly full marks for their comeback victory.
Mike, how would you assess Josh Morrissey's play in this series? And one of the main reasons why I ask, I by the way, think he's been pretty good, and we know that he's coming off of the injury and he missed all of those games towards the end of the season. But, you know, two nights ago, you know, he played 17 and a half minutes. And part of that is because, you know, as you mentioned, the Jets had the 4-minute power play. Morrissey's not, on the top power play unit or the second power play unit. But when you talk about, you know, a guy who has regularly played 23, 24, 25 minutes a night, you know, his ice time is down, you know, regardless of how many Jets power plays there have been.
Yeah, a bit surprising, and I think it's just a question of maybe not trying to overload him, but I do think he's been solid. I certainly not spectacular, but then again, that's not really Josh Morrissey's game, is it? I think he's been quietly very good, but, you know, let's not forget that he is coming back from a pretty major injury, and for him to just step into the lineup and be this dominant force, I think was a bit unrealistic. I don't have any problems at all with his play. I think certainly some of the decision-making by his partner is up for debate, including what exactly Jacob Trouba was doing there in the final 30 seconds of the third, where it seemed like he thought there was a lot less time on the clock than there was, where, you know, he was almost, for some reason, just trying to tie the puck up behind his own net. The simple and smart play there, I think, would have been to move the puck. If the Jets get a zone clear, then we're probably talking about what happened in overtime that night rather than the third period. And look, I mean, maybe the Blues still would have won the game in overtime, but I think anybody watching that game the other night, you had a real sense the Jets were reeling. The Jets needed to get that to overtime just to get into the dressing room to regroup. We saw what they did in overtime in Game 4, but the fact they couldn't even get it there, you know, again, is just a scene that's played out far too often this year.
You know, Mike, one player who seems to have really stepped up his game in the playoffs has been Patrick Laine. What have your impressions been of the Finnish sniper?
Yeah, I think he's been, you know, all around very, very solid. Maybe not quite as noticeable in Game 5, but you could say the same for a lot of his teammates. But I think the body of work has been really strong. And it isn't just the three goals, it's the physical play. There's a playoff style of hockey to his game that, you know, he seems to have taken it to another level, and that's a great sign, right? The Jets obviously hope with their 20-year-old and Patrick Laine that there's a lot of playoff runs, in his and in their future together. And you want a guy that rises to the occasion, that comes up big when you need it. And I think we've seen that. I think Patrick Laine had a very good playoff last year, and I think he's taken another step with his game this year, which is even more encouraging considering the consensus would be that he took a step back with his game during the regular season. So maybe this is the most pleasant surprise of all, that he's been able to find another gear or two at a time when people were starting to wonder if he had another gear or two.
Last question for you, Mike. Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press joining us from St. Louis ahead of tonight's Game 6 between the Jets and the Blues. Craig Berube has outcoached Paul Maurice. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever a team is leading a series, there's a lot of things that they've done better. Early in the series, certainly the first two games, you could say the Blues got the better goaltending. I think the last few games, the Blues are winning the special teams battle. And yeah, I mean, this is not a shot at Paul Maurice, but I think Craig Berube is pushing all the right buttons. Look at what he did with his top six the other day, guys, going into that third period. He made a couple tweaks to his lines, and they produced, and he got the results. So a playoff series, there's all kinds of battles, and the coaching battle is one of them. And I would say right now, for sure, going into Game 6, that the St. Louis Blues are winning that battle just like they're winning a lot of the other ones as well.
The first five games of this series have been pretty epic. We expect nothing less from tonight's Game 6. Mike McIntyre will document it for the Winnipeg Free Press. He joins us from St. Louis. Mike, appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
You bet. Enjoy the game, guys.
Take care, Mike. Thanks again. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Stanley Cup Playoffs game day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Yeah, battle by the net. Puck kind of squared out to the half wall. They just kind of threw it at the net. I don't even know if it was on the ice. I think it hit off his stick or hit it in out of the air or whatever. It's like I said, we're not dwelling on it. It's yesterday. We got to worry about tomorrow.
That's Jets defenseman Jacob Trouba talking about the game-winning play on Thursday night, the one that led the Blues to a 3-2 series lead and a 3-2 win in that contest. Started with him behind the net, really panicking in my estimation, not being able to make a hockey play. It ended with the puck behind Connor Hellebuck. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we are live here on TSN Radio 1290. The Jets and the Blues, Game 6 goes later on tonight, a game you can hear live, of course, on this fine station. This segment of the show is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Bernstein's is proudly family-owned and operated and has been serving quality home-style food since 1985. For a hot, fresh breakfast starting at 6:30 a.m. weekdays and all day long, visit Bernstein's at 1700 Cordon Avenue. That's in the Cordon Village Mall.
By the way, Drew, happy 420.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it as big a deal anymore? I don't think so. There'd be no reason to be celebrating.
People going to smoke in front, it's legal. They don't do anything.
Well, it's not legal to smoke. Not that it was ever legal to smoke it in front of the legislature, but it definitely isn't legal to smoke it because you can't smoke it in public.
No, I mean, but like I'm saying, it's not as big a deal anymore because who cares? Like it's
right. You can just go buy cannabis in a store without having to, you know, have to do it
To make a point.
Yes, exactly.
Your point has been made.
I think people that smoke will use any reason to. So I think it is still a big thing with people that smoke.
Well, you can head down to the ledge, I guess, later on this afternoon and find out for yourself, first and foremost, if it is still a big deal or not.
We're really putting the illegal in our name right now.
There you go.
Drew, are you going to have a puff?
I'm not tonight. No, I'm good. I mean, I don't think it's going to be part of my Passover Seder either. I think it's, you know, the green vegetable that's going to be on your Passover plate, on your Seder plate, I don't think it's going to be cannabis. I think that'll continue to be parsley or celery.
Yeah,
something like that. Anyways. You talk about the defenseman, as you asked Mike McIntyre last segment about Josh Morrissey's play, and you really bring up an interesting point in my mind. Josh Morrissey only played 17 minutes and 20 seconds, and I know the Jets had power play time. They had 6 minutes of power play time in that game last night. Pardon me, a game on Thursday night. But Morrissey playing 17-20 to me is not enough. That's less than what Ben Sherratt played. That's less than what Jacob Trouba played. The only defenseman that played less than Josh Morrissey is Dmitry Kulikov. To me, Morrissey has been solid all series long. He hasn't really been flashy. He hasn't really been noticeable. But that's Josh Morrissey's game.
Yeah, he's not a flashy player.
No,
but
that's Morrissey's game in a nutshell. To me, this is another instance of questionable use by Paul Maurice. Why isn't Josh Morrissey out there eating more minutes for this Jets team?
Well, a part of it, you know the answer. Part of the reason is because he's coming off the injury.
It's been five games now.
No, but he missed a lot. What did he miss, 20?
Yeah, I know, but there's no tomorrow anymore. You can't be waiting.
I'm pretty sure there is going to be a tomorrow.
You know what I mean? You know very well what I meant. I mean, you need. I understand maybe for game one, maybe game two even. But this is a guy who's in
By the way, that was a really morbid thought. There's not going to be a tomorrow anymore.
This is a guy who's in great shape. This is a guy
who just doesn't acknowledge that.
I'm just ignoring you. This is a guy who's in, you know, great physical condition. They talk about how great his conditioning is all season long. You know, is he still injured? It doesn't strike me that he's still injured because he's playing pretty good hockey.
Well, we're not going to know whether or not he's still.
But he's playing good hockey in the 17 minutes that he's playing a game. Why isn't he playing 20 minutes, 21 minutes like the rest of the Jets' best defensemen?
Well, I can give you my answer. Paul Maurice's answer.
I want your answer.
Might be different than that, but I think. I already mentioned, I think it's because they've eased him into the lineup a little bit. I think it has to do a little bit with the fact that, as you mentioned, I mean, you mentioned it, when you have power plays, and the Jets had what, how many?
Six minutes of power plays.
Yeah, three.
Yeah, three. So the double minor and then the puck over glass power penalty.
So, I mean, when you get into three, four, five penalties, I mean, his ice time is going to go down, and that was before this series, right? So those are two answers, right? He's coming off the injury. He's not out there on the power play. So those are two reasons. And I think partly due to that, Ben Sherrod is playing more, right? Because of the matchups. And I think Josh Morrissey, I agree with you. I think Morrissey's been, I don't think game five was his best game. I'll say that. But I think he has been very good in the series. And Morrissey gives you reliable play. Yep. I mean, he's a very solid defensive defenseman. And he also had a good year offensively this year. I mean, I think sometimes that's underrated, or an underrated part of his game is his offensive element. So I think there are a few reasons. Paul Maurice is never going to tell you the reason why he's playing less is because he wants Ben Sherratt out there more for the matchups. But I think when you get down to playoff time, we know that that's what it ultimately comes down to. If you want Ben Sherratt and Dustin Byfuglien up against, you know, Ryan O'Reilly's line, you're going to put Sherrod out there more.
Every time that the Kulikov and Myers pairing was out there on Thursday night, you felt as though something's going to happen. It's not necessarily going to be positive. And to see that Josh Morrissey, I mean, Morrissey playing 17 minutes to me, there's a good 4 or 5 more minutes that he has in his game without it being too taxing. And to me, it's relatively inexplicable that he's not playing those minutes, Dave.
Well, and remember, he was still skating, right? Because it was an upper body.
That's right. It wasn't cardiovascular.
Right. So for Morrissey, we know has nothing to do with his lower body. He was able to continue to skate, unlike Dustin Byfuglien, who wasn't skating, obviously. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, look, Josh Morrissey is arguably your best defenseman on this team. And to have Myers, Kulikov anywhere close, to me, I agree with you, Drew. I you're watching that game and you're thinking to yourself, these guys are, you know, they're you're kind of waiting for that shoe to drop. You're waiting for something to happen. So, I don't know. I mean, to Ezzie's point, I'm not sure if there's still some lingering issues with respect to the injury that we don't know about. And obviously, we're not going to find out about until after the series or after the playoffs are done for the Jets, whenever that is. We won't find that out. But, I mean, they were fairly even across the board. But, I mean, yeah, you're right. You probably could find a few extra minutes here and there to get that pairing on as opposed to the Kulikov and Myers pairing. But
he played 23 minutes and 17 seconds in game four. And then he drops 6 minutes in game five. So, I mean,
how many power plays, though, were there in that game?
I'd have to go back and check again.
I don't think there were that many. I think there were one or two.
It was only 6 minutes of power plays. It wasn't 16 minutes of power plays. I mean, that shouldn't mean that his minutes dropped back to 17 minutes a game.
No, I'm with you. I was the one that brought it up.
Yeah, I know you were brought it up with Mike.
So, I mean, I would like to see Morrissey probably closer to whatever it is, guys. I mean, I think we get fixated a little bit too much on exact numbers. I think we'd all agree that it's somewhere between 20 and 22 minutes is ideally where you want Josh Morrissey.
Yes.
I don't necessarily know that he has to play 26 minutes a game.
No, not saying 26 minutes.
That's Buff minutes. I mean, Buff is out there on the power play. He's out there on the first power play. He's out there on the penalty kill. And he's obviously, you know, he is Maurice's minute muncher.
Yeah.
Right? And Josh Morrissey has the ability to play those types of minutes. But I think the point is, now that it's later in the series, I think earlier in the series, maybe you would expect the minutes to be a little bit lower. But you look at Buff, and, you know, Dave mentions, you know, upper body versus lower body, Buff being upper body,
Morrissey being upper body.
Right.
Yeah.
Then you could make the argument that Buff should be playing less, but he goes right into the lineup and he played big minutes. I mean, Buff comes off of an injury and he's at 25 minutes, right?
He was 24 minutes on Thursday, yeah.
But when he came back for his first game,
he was right back in the lineup. There was no easing him in.
Right. Buff doesn't play 15 minutes a game. He goes in and he plays 24, 25 plus minutes. So It'll be interesting to see if Morrissey plays more. I would expect him to play a little bit more in a key game five. And by the way, Morrissey and Trouba have been out there primarily against the Blues top line, but you've also seen Sherratt and Buff out there against the top line. So I think that's partly due to that. If you want to get Buff out there more, and we know he has a huge impact physically, well, you got to put Sherratt out there with Buff.
I have no problem with that. Sherratt has been perfectly fine in the series. To me, it's Morrissey's numbers. The fact that Morrissey is that much lower than Ben Sherratt, I think Ben Sherratt's been great. But the fact that you're telling me that Josh Morrissey is playing less than Ben Sherratt, and I know it has to do with who his partner is, to me is a poor usage of your left side defense. There's more minutes that Morrissey can play on that left side, and I don't for the life of me understand why he's not getting those minutes. Much more on the Jets and the Blues to come throughout the show. When we come back, Dave McCarthy of NHL.com is going to join us. We look at another playoff series that's going to a game six. That's the Bruins and the Leafs. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals, Winnipeg Jets, Stanley Cup Playoffs, game day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio, 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk with you in studio. Producer Sean Asor doing a great job behind the board. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. That's the best way to reach us in studio to talk about the Jets and the Blues series. You can also do it via text message. Send your text to 129090. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to be joined by Dave McCarthy of NHL.com. He joins us to talk about the Bruins and the Leafs series. The Leafs with a huge victory in Game 5. They take a 3-2 series lead heading home for tomorrow afternoon's Game 6. Dave, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. What's going on, guys?
Not too much, Dave. First of all, we got to start with the, I'm sure, what is the topic of conversation, both in Toronto and Boston. The Maple Leafs open the scoring on a controversial goal. Auston Matthews gets credit. Zach Hyman is alleged to have interfered with Tuukka Rask. I thought it was interference. The NHL, review of it said it wasn't interference. In your opinion, was it goaltender interference?
It was pretty darn close. I honestly wasn't sure. Not that I'm ever really sure, because it does tend to be a very inexact science when it goes to goalie interference. But in this case, I was particularly unsure as to what the call might be. And I was probably, if I had to bet before the call had been made, I was going to be maybe a little bit more on the side of goalie interference than not. But I guess the league determined that it wasn't. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, I think, as I've understood it, as the rule book has suggested it, and from things that I've heard in talking to people around the league, is that they want the referee's call to mean something. And in that case, unless there's incontrovertible evidence that speaks to overturning the call, whatever it might have been, they're more inclined to stick with the referee's call. You know, we saw it in the later game there in the Calgary game when Philip Grubauer got interfered with on the Johnny Gaudreau goal. The referee called it off on the ice right away. He ruled no goal.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have made an argument there that Grubauer was embellishing a little bit. I mean, my first thought was, well, why did he dive in the opposite direction of where the puck was? But ultimately, they decided that, you know what, we're going to go with the referee's call, because you can make an argument both ways, and the referee called it no goal, so we'll go with no goal. So I think that's what they're trying to do, is have the referee's call mean something. So I think the fact that the ref called Auston Matthews' goal a goal on the ice went a long way into determining that it was, in fact, a goal.
Dave, we got to stick with Auston Matthews. I mean, you know that in last year's playoffs, the seven-game series, he only had one goal, and I think you'd agree, and he would agree, that he didn't play his best hockey. He's on a three-game goal-scoring streak. You know, the last three games, he's been arguably the Leafs' best player. What are you seeing out of Matthews that is leading to his success over the last three games?
Well, I think last night was his best game of the three. And the reason he had success is because he was coming back into his own end. He was an outlet defensively. He was digging in defensively. He was playing the entire ice. And as a result, he started to get chances. And that's what the Leafs need out of him. You know, Mike Babcock said last night, people will kind of roll their eyes and say, when you're a great player, well, of course you'll be able to play 200 feet. But that's not necessarily the case, because honestly, guys, when you're a good player, when you're a great player, that means when you were a kid coming up through minor hockey, you had the puck all the time. You never needed to play defense because you just outskated all the other kids on the ice and no one could get the puck off you. But the NHL level doesn't work like that. And, you know, you need to learn how to play that way. And I think over the last couple of years, Austin's really improved in that regard. Mitch Marner's really improved in that regard. And you're starting to see some of the maturation of the Leafs' younger players that they consider a part of their core that are now helping them play better when games are tight, helping them play better when they're trying to lock up a lead in the third period. They haven't lost in regulation this year when they've been leading after two periods. I think a lot of that goes to the fact that guys like Matthews, guys like Marner, are a lot more comfortable when they don't have the puck. And as a result, they're getting a lot of ice time. They're being played in those situations. They're being relied upon, and they're coming true.
You know, Dave, speaking specifically about Mitch Marner, what have you noticed in his game that is really elevated? Because, like you said, there's opportunity in the playoffs to blossom as a player, and you can also wilt. And it seems like he's really stepped up his game for the Leafs in the postseason.
Mitch Marner?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's stepped up his play. I don't know if I could really say he stepped up his play that much, because he's been really dynamic the entire regular season. He's been the best player, I think, for the Maple Leafs starting since the second half of last season. And he was the best player in the playoffs last year. He was the best player during the regular season this year. And he's certainly been one of, if not the best player this year in the postseason. So I don't know if he's really stepped up, but what I think he's done is, like Matthews recently, I think Marner's made the conversion maybe a little bit earlier, he's blossomed into a 200-foot player. And he's involved in all aspects of the game. Mike Babcock uses him to kill penalties now. He gets probably 2.5-3 minutes of ice extra a night killing penalties because he's involved in that area of the game. He's become an offensive threat shorthanded. He's become a guy that they can match up against the Bergeron line in this series along with Tavares and Hyman and not have to worry about that line when it comes to their defensive responsibilities. And then, of course, when he gets an opportunity to chip in offensively, you don't need to worry about that. You know he's going to be dangerous just about on every shift. So the fact that he's become a complete player and is involved in every asset of the game, to me, has made Marner completely invaluable. People say, well, Matthews, he doesn't play enough. He only plays 18 minutes a night. He needs to play 21, 22 minutes a night. Well, tell you what, if great players like to work on a skill and hone a new skill, every summer, every offseason, come back in the fall with a new weapon at hand, my advice to Austin Matthews would be get involved in the penalty killing unit and find a way to become good at that. And then go to Mike Babcock, go to your coach in September and say, look, coach, I want you to use me killing penalties. I want to be involved. Here's what I've done to prove to you that I'm ready to take that next step. And then you're going to find Austin playing 22 minutes a night. Mitch Marner's done that. I think that's the next step for Austin to make, to be honest with you.
Dave McCarthy of NHL.com is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, talking about the Bruins and the Leafs. The Leafs victorious last night. They lead the series 3-2 ahead of tomorrow afternoon's Game 6. Dave, you know, this Maple Leafs team was fairly woeful with their defensive structure all season long, yet the playoffs
that's
have started. Yeah, but you know, that's my point, Dave. You know, the playoffs have started, and they've been able to just, you know, using the cliche, flip that switch, and they look like a completely different team when it comes to being responsible. You know, why is that? Is that a testament to Mike Babcock, or is that a testament to maybe some professionalism in the room that allowed them to decide that they knew they couldn't play the run and gun style that had been their MO all season long?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm honestly shocked, because I did not think for the life of me the Leafs had this in them. Because we never saw it once, all season long. Never, ever did we see them play like this. And it's very difficult to flip a switch at playoff time. And what the Leafs have done in this series, by and large, pretty well in every game but game two. Game five wasn't necessarily a particularly defensive game either. But anyway, point is, this is as proverbial a flipping of the switch as you can get. And to me, it's really impressive because I did not know they had this in them. But this is the way that you have to play come playoff time to win. Mike Babcock's been saying it all year long. He's been preaching structure. He's been preaching defense. He's been preaching how you need to make sure there's no room out there for the other team. And a lot of people that I know in the media and fans all year long rolled their eyes. Oh, this guy never lets up, never gives it a rest. Look at this Leafs team. They got all this skill. They're just going to run around. They're going to score five goals every game. That's how they're going to win. That's not how you win in the playoffs. And now I think Mike Babcock, the way he's coached this series, the way he's matched his lines, the way the defensive structure is starting to show up, I think he's starting to get some credit finally, because the way the Leafs played last night was a Mike Babcock type of game, and the reason they won last night is because they played the way they did last night. So I think Mike Babcock deserves a ton of credit for what he's been able to instill. And now I think maybe it was instilled earlier. I think it may just speak to the fact that there was a little bit of disinterest in the Leafs room right now because they were locked into a playoff spot for so long. And another thing I'm big on is human nature, and people roll their eyes at that. But, yeah, when you're up as comfortably as the Leafs were on a playoff spot for 2 months, and you know when you go to the rink on a Tuesday night, if we win, if we lose, it's probably not going to make all that much of a difference. So whatever, we'll just go out, we'll run and gun, we'll try and win this game 6-5 and see what happens. I think that speaks to a little bit of apathy. But now they know when stuff is on the line, okay, boys, got to bring it tonight, and they have. Didn't think they could, didn't think it's that easy, but they've been showing they've been able to do it.
Dave, we have to ask you about Jake Muzzin. You had an article for sharpmagazine.com about Muzzin and, you know, talking about how he idolized the Leafs growing up, how he almost quit hockey after he went undrafted, yeah. About the transition from LA playing with Drew Doughty to Toronto prior to the NHL trade deadline. And I think you'd agree Muzzin has been very good in this series, and for a player who received a lot of criticism after he was acquired from the Los Angeles Kings, I think he's actually done a really good job paired up with Nikita Zaitsev.
100%. Okay, I have the answer to that. He did deserve a ton of criticism. Do you know why? He's a human being. Do you know what was going on in his life? His wife was pregnant, very pregnant. She had the baby 2 days ago. So when he was traded, she was, what, 6-7 months pregnant? That's not easy. And he said, look, this isn't like moving from Detroit to Toronto, where I could nip home on an off day and be back later that night, no big deal. Moving across the continent. So I was worried about making sure my wife was good. We had to find another doctor. We had to find a place to live. We had to make sure she was comfortable. We had to make sure everything with my family was taken care of. And that's not easy to do. He said, you know what, my mind was on that a little bit. And now that we've got everything settled, he was telling me when we did this article about a couple of weeks ago, it's been a lot more easy to focus because he knows family life is under control. So, you know, everyone's quick to judge and, oh, look, he's not playing good. These people are not robots. You know, numbers are nice and everything, but they don't tell the whole story because I bet you didn't know that, right? So put yourself in his position, and I think anybody would feel the same way. If you know, you or I had to move to Los Angeles and our wives were pregnant and we had to start doing a radio show and had to leave them behind, yeah, we probably wouldn't do as good a show. So it's just the fact that these guys are humans and they go through a lot off the ice people don't know about that cannot help but affect what they're able to do on the ice at times. And it goes to why mental clarity and mental strength is so important in terms of athletic and physical performance. You talk to any elite level trainer, they talk about mental stability and all that, and that importance to making sure you're performing your best physically. That's what went into it. So that's why he got some criticism. The way he's playing now is unbelievable. And if you're a Leaf fan, thank goodness they went out and got Jake Muzzin, because he has been outstanding on that pairing with Nikita Zaitsev, keeping the Bergeron line under control. and helping Jake Gardner with the fact that he's not well right now. If you watch Jake Gardner play, there's no way that he could play the role that Jake Muzzin's playing right now. With the back injury that he's dealing with, if you look at him skate, he's a shell of his former self. He can barely move around the rink the way that he's used to. That's why he only played 12 and a half minutes last night. He's grinding through it. Can you imagine if the Leafs didn't have Jake Muzzin? They'd be in a world of trouble. So Muzzin deserves a ton of credit. He's played great, and he's coming up big for this team exactly when they need it. Not only is he playing well defensively, but he's getting it done on the offensive side, setting up Austin Matthews. An inspired play that was. Anyone would have shot that puck. He took two extra steps, found Austin for the one-timer, and a better chance. Jake Muzzin deserves a ton of credit, guys.
Dave, if you're offering an opportunity to do the radio show in Los Angeles, by the way, we'll take it.
Dave
so
McCarthy.
But my girlfriend's not pregnant, so easy decision.
Dave McCarthy is the Leafs correspondent, the Toronto correspondent for NHL.com. Dave, appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Great being on with you, boys. Keep on.
Take care, Dave. Thanks again. When we come back, we discuss Steve Yzerman being hired by the Detroit Red Wings as their new general manager. Much more to come still throughout the course of the show on the Jets and the Blues. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals, Winnipeg Jets, Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
As you know, my family's here. Our kids are here. We kept our home here and come back in the off season. But honestly, when I left, I thought Kenny is going to be the manager for X. Jim Neal's going to take over for Kenny. And, you know, I'm going to be 100 before I get to be the manager of the Red Wings. So, quite frankly, I feel 100 right about now.
Steve Yzerman.
No, it's not Yzerman. It's Steve Yzerman.
I don't understand the reference.
Bill Clinton. Remember when the Red Wings went to the White House and Bill Clinton said, "I'd like to welcome Steve Yzerman"?
No, I don't remember that, but I'm amazed that you do.
That's one of my all-time favorite.
Yeah, how do you not remember
clips?
That? I mean, you're Mr. Politics.
Steve Yzerman.
Well, I must have blocked that out of my memory for whatever reason.
Steve Yzerman.
I apologize. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve. Anyways, that was Steve Yzerman or Steve Yzerman. He's the new general manager of the Detroit
Just
Red
call
Wings.
Call him Stevie Y, baby.
We'll call him Stevie Y. I can do that. Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live here on TSN Radio 1290. We're part of Industrial Metals, Winnipeg Jets, Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day, the Jets and the Blues later on tonight. 6 p.m. puck drop shortly thereafter here on this station. Much more on the Jets and the Blues throughout the next 90 or so minutes. This segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. So Yzerman, of course, was the general manager of the Tampa Bay Lightning until earlier, or I guess before the season started when he resigned, you know, to spend more time with his family or whatever it was to, you know, there was a shift in duties there.
Transition
to Julien Brisebois in Tampa Bay. Now he goes back home to Detroit to be their general manager, displacing Ken Holland as GM. Is this a good move for the Red Wings? This Red Wings franchise has sort of been, I actually thought they played better than their record indicated for a lot of this season, but this Red Wings franchise has sort of been floundering for the last number of years. Is the addition of Steve Yzerman just a huge, you know, jet boost to the franchise?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, you mentioned floundering, and obviously, you know, they've missed the playoffs the last 2 years or 3 years?
I can't remember. I think
3 years. 3 years now, right, yeah. Dave? And, you know, Dave is our Michigan correspondent for LegalCurve.com, so we have to mention that. But, I mean, we know that Steve Yzerman was going to ultimately make the move, right, guys? We were talking about that at the beginning of the season. I mean, everybody knew that Stevie Y was going to go to Detroit, you know, for personal reasons, for family reasons. But there's also, you know, the elephant in the room is Ken Holland actually going to take the job in Seattle, right? And there are other individuals who have been linked to the Seattle job. Kelly McCrimmon, Dave, is a guy that we know might end up taking that job, but the Vegas Golden Knights are in the middle of a playoff series right now. So obviously, you know, the Seattle ownership group, they can't talk to Kelly McCrimmon,
right?
Because you just can't. So, I mean, there always is the chance still that Ken Holland moves on and becomes the first GM of the Seattle franchise.
Well, I should say, sorry, I should have mentioned that. So as Yzerman gets the job as GM, you know, Ken Holland gets a new title as senior vice president and senior advisor to hockey operations. So it's right. Sort of of sounds, you know, like a dignified position, and it sounds sort of like, you know, he's still going to be a key member in the team. Don't buy it. I don't buy it. I mean, Ken Holland might be getting the title. He gets a new contract. But to me, that this is putting Ken Holland on a shelf somewhere in, you know, in the closet. He's not going to be involved in the day-to-day decision-making of the Detroit Red Wings.
Yeah, it's possible, Drew. And you know, we talked about it off-air before the segment, right? We're talking about, you know, we've heard that Seattle wants a GM in place probably sometime in June, July. I mean, obviously, they don't have a draft pick coming up in Vancouver. But the point is, I mean, they have a lot of work to do in the next 2 years. They don't come into the league until 21-22, but they've said that the ownership group, and we've had Jeff Baker of Seattle Times on, and he's mentioned that they want a GM in place, you know, before, you know, next season. Some people thought they might wait until, you know, fall of 2019, but, you know, Joe Smith of The Athletic, we've had him on the show before, and, you know, he had an article talking about, you know, how this move is going to affect the rest of the guys in the Tampa Bay front office, right? So you're talking about Pat Verbeek. You're talking about Al Murray, their chief amateur scout. I mean, Al Murray, I mean, he's the guy that drafted Nikita Kucherov. He's the guy that drafted Braden Point, Anthony Cirelli, Matthew Joseph. I mean, all of these players, and these are not first round top 10 picks. I mean, when you're talking about Kucherov, mm-hmm. I mean, Kucherov was what, 37th overall, something like that. He was a second round pick in 2011. And when you're talking about Point, he wasn't a first rounder either. So, I mean, Al Murray, is he going to follow Yzerman, Dave?
Pat Verbeek is rumored to be maybe a candidate in Edmonton.
Yeah, I mentioned Verbeek, and you mentioned Edmonton. I mean, Verbeek is going to leave Tampa Bay possibly. So if you're Julian Brisebois, you might have to hire an assistant general manager. You might have to hire a new chief amateur scout. I mean, right now, this is not a great position for Brisebois to be in, because with Stevie Y leaving, he might take, you know, his two main guys with him.
And one thing we've seen with Tampa with under the Yzerman tenure is the fact that they've built up a good AHL system in Syracuse. And one yep. thing that's always been a testament to the Red Wings was what it was their big thing was that Ken Holland always ensured that the AHL farm club was a place to develop their players before they made the NHL. That was the Detroit model before anybody else had it, was guys didn't just automatically have a berth in the NHL. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say like Dylan Larkin was probably the break in that mold, because for the longest time, guys played, toiled away in the AHL, developed their forwards, defense, goalies. It didn't matter. That's where you went. You went to the AHL. You played right now with the Grand Rapids Griffins, who have been a really good team. They kind of stumbled towards the end of the season, but I think they won their first game in the playoffs, in the Calder Cup playoffs against Chicago just the last couple days ago. But the fact is that you've had a history with Detroit of having a very good AHL team and then a good NHL team. It's been the last three seasons now. They haven't made the playoffs. They've been accumulating picks. And like, I agree with you, Drew, they did start to get better towards the end of the season. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that can, we know Daniel doesn't quote carry over, but I think Steve Yzerman is going to bring some new talent, some fresh faces, and maybe get back to what we saw with Detroit years past.
You know, Dave, and just another point here, Drew, I know quickly we got to get to break here, but, you know, you mentioned Dylan Larkin. Dylan Larkin had a really quiet career year, and you're talking about Thanasio. He had a 30-goal season. I mean, Anthony Mantha, he had a 25-goal season. Tyler Bertuzzi, he scored 20 goals. I mean, the Red Wings were not a playoff team, but the Red Wings were not an easy team to play against. And, you know, you talk about Filip Zadina, 6th overall pick. He played a little bit for the Red Wings, but mainly in the American Hockey League. Yep. Michael Rasmussen, I mean, he had his rookie year this year, and obviously he's only 19 years old. But you're talking about, you know, the Red Wings having the 6th overall pick in this year's draft. And so the Red Wings have some high-end talent. Joe Valeno is another guy. He was the last pick in the 2018 first-round draft.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about four or five really good prospects, plus the 6th overall pick in the upcoming draft. I mean, Steve Yzerman is joining a franchise that has missed the playoffs the last few years, but they're also, I think, a franchise that's trending in the right direction.
They've already bottomed out, and now they're heading back upwards. I would agree with that. So we'll keep an eye on what happens in Detroit. We'll keep an eye on the future of Ken Holland if he ends up in Seattle. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Andy Graziano of WFAN Radio. He covers the New York Islanders. The Islanders are off to the second round. The Jets are about to hit the ice for morning skate ahead of Game 6 in St. Louis. It's all happening, and you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals, Winnipeg Jets, Stanley Cup Playoffs Game Day on your home of the Jets, TSN Radio 12-9.
The team captain, Steve Yzerman.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.